Match Boy. Overlooking Phoenix. From high above in the Star Worldwide Network studios. Badge Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another edition of the Badge Boys, the show where two cops talk to the community. I'm retired Crime Stopper Sergeant Darren Birch.
I'm retired Phoenix Police Officer Jason Schechterly.
And we have another stellar show for you today. We have Chief Ray Naho, 35-year career in law enforcement. He started in the mid-70s with the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a police officer, on-the-job training with a broken gun. Yeah, we're going to hear that story. Then he became a Phoenix cop, retired, then became Gila River Police Chief. Incredible career, but some really interesting stories as it relates to the tribal police. Then we go into cop talk, where we're going to talk about hashtag defend police.
Defund.
What I say.
Not defend, because nobody's doing that. We will talk about that.
That's a Freudian slip on my part,
because
I'm ready to defend the police here.
I never jump into your intros, but on that one, I'm like, you know what? We're going to cover
both. It's going to get heated.
This hashtag defund police, we're going to defend police. And then we're also going to talk about the Minneapolis police chief fighting with the unions. And then at the last segment, we're going to have stupid suspect stories galore, our heroic headlines, and of course, Jason's inspirational message. So stay tuned, stay informed, and most of all, you can be entertained.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Jason, when you were a police officer, did you have that one cop that you kind of looked up to? He might have been a senior officer, may not, may have just been a partner in academy, but is someone that you really kind of inspired to be like?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
We are right now in the studio with someone that I felt that way about, Chief Ray Naho. I knew him as just Ray. We were squad partners together in the late 80s, and he was I call him a meat eater. He would go out and do, you always talk about OV work, Jason, and he would do on view, observational.
Mind your own stuff.
He did. He just got into the shit. We call him a shit magnet. And he would find all sorts of stuff. Yeah, he was. He would find something everywhere. I didn't know about his stellar career before and after he left the Phoenix Police Department. So we hooked up in social media, which is great, LinkedIn, and I learned so much I didn't know about someone who I call friend, Ray. So without further ado, Ray, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
35 years with law enforcement, 21-year career with the Phoenix Police Department, if I'm correct.
That's correct.
You then end up going into tribal police in different facets, also state, and you end up at one point as the Gila River police chief.
Yes.
Amazing. Correct. Can you kind of start from the very beginning and tell me the story of when you became a cop in California with the Bureau of Indian Affairs with a gun that didn't work?
Okay. Well, it's a true story, except for the fact it was right here in Arizona.
My bad.
That's okay. When I first started in law enforcement here, I was out of the military. I came from California looking for work. As you got released and discharged, I hired on with the Bureau of Indian Affairs right out here at Fort McDowell. And back at that time, the academy that the Bureau had was restricted, and only so many slots were open during the time period. So they had what they called the OJT, special officer training. And that's what I was put in.
OJT Special Officer Training.
Special Officer. They wanted, I guess it was some title making you feel good. But what happened was I ended up, they handed me a card. It had my name on it, so I knew it belonged to me. It's signed by my boss. And that was my credentials. No picture, nothing else, no fingerprint.
Day one.
And this was after I went out and bought the uniform, bought the pants, bought the leather gear, because they didn't issue it to you. You had to buy it. And these are one of the perks of being an Indian cop, is that you had to buy your own stuff to get out there to do the job. But one thing that really struck me was they handed me a six-shooter, a revolver. You know, these, you're talking, because these are the olden days, not the automatics.
The wheel gun.
Right, when ships were wood, men were iron. Yeah, okay, that's what we were up to. So I ended up with this gun, and I remember looking at it, and I couldn't help noticing that and I'm no firearms expert, but it didn't take a genius to figure out that cylinder's bent in that frame. So I asked the boss, I said, what's wrong with this? And he said, is it broken? And he goes, well, it doesn't really work. I go, what do you mean?
And he said,
you'll get one shot. It may rotate or bind. You might not get a second shot. And then he said the remarkable words that made me really wonder why I signed on with the Bureau. So I asked him, I go, well, what do I do with this if I have to use it? And God forbid. And his words of wisdom, throw rocks at him. Quote, unquote, throw rocks at him. I'm going, okay, you're a government official. That's the best you can do.
You're my supervisor.
I go, no wonder Indians just love Indian agents. No wonder. I said, this is ridiculous. So I went out and I took the gun off and I wore the leather gear without the holster. But at that time, again, OJT was when the guy was there to actually show you stuff. And if he took time off, you rode the road yourself. And I was like, OJT.
Without any real training.
No formal training, nothing. So you had to rely on your wits and discretion.
Common sense.
And believe me, you exercise a lot of discretion if you're not armed and you're alone.
You talk yourself out of things.
And you have no backup and you have no radio contact.
Wow.
These are the days before portables, the days before pagers, and the days before backup. Because the government contracts were very thin at that time in Indian country, like I guess sometimes today is still kind of on the lower rung of the ladder of funding. But to give you an understanding of how dangerous that job actually got, aside from being almost foolish, when I wrote citations, and I think you folks have all seen the Western movies, and Indians standing on the hill there looking at the cavalry come by, with you have the guy standing with a rifle crutched in his arm, the Indian scout kind of thing. Well, that's what I looked like writing the traffic ticket, because I had my backup weapon in the car was a 30-30 lever action, and there were no other weapons. But I didn't call in 28s or 29s, the records checks and family checks, because there was no one to call it into. So you just basically figured, okay, you must be a good person because you haven't killed me, so I'll go ahead and sign the citation and off you go. Bad guys would come and go, so definitely there was a little bit lax in law enforcement. But I think I told the story one time. I used to tell it to the guys here beside, I carried the gun that didn't shoot, and the guys would laugh at me going, are you crazy? And I said, that's why I joined PD, because Phoenix gave you a gun that did shoot.
And a little bit of training.
And
the boot.
A little bit of training. To me, that was like stellar, because I had yet to see a gun that actually fired other than the range up at that point. So this is where my career started, and I was so glad to get on PPD.
Tell me about, I don't even know a good word for it, but the transition from living in the res, being a cop in the res, and then all of a sudden you're in the big city. And it wasn't the fifth largest city then, but it was still a big city in the
VS-70. Yes, it was pretty good size.
What was that transition like?
Coming from a reservation, especially my reservation, and if you know anything about California, where I come from, my reservation is basically what we used to call a postage stamp on the side of a mountain. Not very large, minimal community size, and we had no law enforcement like you understand in Arizona without the auspices of the sheriff's office coming in and taking care of business. Two completely different federal systems. But being as isolated as we were, the cultural growth of young Indians was handled by elders, grandparents, uncles, aunts, etc., the family unit. So we had that growing up, that difference between ourselves on federal land and non-Indians off federal land. So while I went to public school, many of my relatives and elders went to Indian schools. And that was a complete government transition, a complete difference. I was glad to go to the public school because I could assimilate sooner. They were forced to go to Indian schools because they were forced to give up the culture to assimilate as mandatory transition from Indian culture to non-Indian culture. So coming from there to, say, a large metropolitan area was like night and day. I mean, I was used to just my next-door neighbor is half a mile away, that kind of thing. And if I wanted to go hunting, I just laid the rifle or pistol out the back window and fired at what I wanted to shoot at because that was good. Or if I wanted to go hiking up on the hill or go hunting, I just took off and did it and come back at the end of the day. Here, the restrictions of society put it down that, you know, you had to behave yourself, essentially. And this is where being a cop here was essentially difficult, a little difficult for me because I wasn't used to the interaction at the degree that you would have in a city department versus growing up with limited interaction on a reservation. And to be honest with you, when we talk about interactions, we talk about all interactions, right? Now, you folks are non-native. That's basically what I call non-Browns. You guys are the non-Browns.
I'm very white.
Yeah.
Me too.
As I look around the room, all y'all's is pretty glowing in here.
It's glare.
I may be the more mellow light in the room right now, but you guys are definitely non-Browns. But that's that we talk about, and you have this issue today where you have the interactions. So understanding that, I know, kind of drives a conversation. But in truth, when I was in the Army, I had an experience that I really never thought about it until I was confronted with this under an official military board where I was an MP in the Army overseas, and I ended up, the story is very simple. I ended up with confronting two guys, two African-American black soldiers, who had forged a pass to get off base from a restricted area. My job was to enforce that restriction. And that wasn't really hard because we were in Korea. So when two black soldiers and African-American soldiers are walking with a bunch of Korean folks, it's pretty easy to pick out who's a GI.
Out.
Yeah, so in confronting them, I did what I did, and of course the pass they had was forged. I did my report, I sent it back, and sure enough, I get a call within days to go before a civil review board because allegations were made that as a military policeman, I was racially biased against these guys.
Wow.
And I had no idea what that was because I'm like, how can you figure? I did my job. I just did what I was supposed to. We went before the board, and this is where I saw the actual experience of the lack of communication and understanding between cultures and people. Because at the time, the board was trying to balance race relations between the soldiers of both races, and it was always black and white. Never the Indian or any other race was brought into it. And this is where this thing almost got comical, because the two soldiers testified, of course, that I was heavy-handed, the police were profiling them because they were African-American and because I had no right to stop them, that type of thing. I picked on them basically because of their race. And I
hate to say it, but played the race card.
Yeah, exactly. They threw it down. They threw down the card. I threw down the blanket. I put it that way, okay? I get up there on the stand, and the officer who is conducting the meeting, he's a black captain. I remember Captain Brown. I can remember his name. I can see his face. He's right here in front of me, and he goes, "Tell me, specials, what is your interaction with black people?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, when did you have any real interaction with people of other races?" I said, "Well, to be honest with you," I said, "I had never interacted with black people until I came in the Army." And then follow-up question just hit right after that. "So you grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood." And I sat there for a second.
Not exactly.
I sat there for a second. I go, "Well, sir, with all due respect, there weren't many white people around where I grew up either." And that's when because the board got silent all of a sudden. They're like, and the major, who was the presiding officer, said, "Are you trying to be funny?" And I go, "No, sir." He says, "Well, okay, then tell us, where did you grow up?" I said, "I grew up on an Indian reservation." And as soon as I said that, you could see the clouds clear. It was like the angels were singing in the back, and I could hear my ancestors singing the ceremonials going, get him, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm sitting there, everybody's silent. So one of the major, the commanding officer, says, "Tell us, specialist, what is it like to grow up on an Indian reservation?" Now, if anybody who knows me, and I know you guys I work with, you know me, you give me that outlet, I'm going to take it and run.
Yeah.
Okay, if you're going to hand me the ranch, I'll burn it down. Okay, so all I said was, "Well, this is how it is." And I started on every issue that ever happened to every Indian everywhere. Even the ones I didn't know happened, I made it up as I went along. And as I did, it was like firing flaming arrows from this quiver of against these people who had the idea that this is how you're supposed to address this. And I made it a point of how terrible the Indian people had been treated. And I mean, I put it on there. And like I said, I waited on really thick. Even though my people had never seen a buffalo on the flip side, except on the flip side of a nickel, I made them feel like, "Oh, my God, we have really
returned the buffaloes.
Oh, my God, yeah. this poor person. I mean, we should give him the base. Just let him go ahead. And
sure.
You know, get him out of here." I survived that hearing only because of a misunderstanding in the communication of cultures. And from there is when I first realized one, that I had a possible ace in my pocket if I ever got in trouble.
You had that blanket.
I could throw the blanket anywhere I wanted to. So as long as I kept it civil, I could definitely cause some issue. But at the same time, there was a difference out there. And when I came to Phoenix, I was assigned with downtown. We were assigned to the District 5 area. I ran into all of these folks, and I worked the East Van Buren area where the heavy prostitution was.
Yeah.
And what were the girls? Predominantly black. But I could assimilate with them because I kind of understood, because everything else was not race-related. And when I came out of my shell, you might say, the introversion of growing from the res and transition to be able to contact and talk to people and not be afraid of the conversation that I'm going to say something wrong, but really just talk to them one-on-one. That's when I think I really understood the fact that the transition, what I thought was difficult, may have been because I didn't understand where I was going and they didn't understand where I came from.
Yeah.
But once that bridge was gapped, I mean, a gap was bridged, I might say, once that bridge was made between the two, that's where the communication took place. And that's where I think my career really benefited from it.
And speaking of your career, 21 years for the Phoenix Police Department, and Jason, when we were working together, again, this guy was a OV hound.
I love it.
He was.
I love it. And I say that, Darren, because I only spent, you know, very limited time on the streets, but it drove me crazy, all the cops out there who waited for the radio. I'm like, when you're not doing something, that's when you're free to go really keep community mm-hmm. safe, drive through neighborhoods, find something that just doesn't look right, that whole intuition, gut instinct. The whole purpose of being a cop, the things I grew up on watching the shows in the 60s and 70s, so I love to hear that he was the king of OV work, because OV work, that's why you're out there. You're not out there to sit and do nothing.
And he knew his beat like the back of his hand. He really did.
Central City Precinct, baby.
And the area we worked was off of Indian School and I-17. For those listening in Chicago and New York, it's just the heart of Phoenix, where it's a bad area. And
great,
there was a place called the Golden 8-Ball.
And oh, God.
I'm bringing you back, aren't I?
It no longer exists, and just to be clear.
Thanks to people like Chief Neho, the Golden 8-Ball no longer exists. But tell us a little bit, if you will, about the Golden 8-Ball, about some of the OV work there.
The Golden 8-Ball, 2740 West Indian School. I never heard of it. That was part of the beat area. And the reason I could say I got into it is because I was essentially assigned. It was a hub of criminal and drug activity. But one of the things I did was to kind of shy away from the drive-through OV option, get out of the car, sit in the tree like I was a kid, sit in the tree where I could, hide behind the wall, look through the cracks, watch what I needed to watch, see what I needed to see, then walk up on them and basically ambush them like my ancestors did. I often thought, I'm coming out with the sun on my back, you know, whooping and a hollering, came off the hill, burned down the wagon, I got them. Get there, get in, get out, get the scout before they see you coming. And that's essentially the tactics I used. I learned them from the res.
Hunting. And that tactic served you well because you end up going into drug enforcement.
Right.
And can you tell us a little bit about the end of your career and where you're at and what you did?
I went into what they called it then, the knock and talk squad. And I really didn't believe you could talk somebody into giving up their dope.
They do.
But they did. And I was like, oh, man. I think having the gift of gab and a little bit the ability to communicate at the level I did and help them understand that I'm really not out there to ruin their life, but I'm more than willing to put them in jail. If they didn't see the difference, I would be successful. And when I realized that there was more to the job, I was offered up a position on the clandestine drug squad. That's why I said I've got a skill now that I can use since I retired. So the DEA taught me how to make meth. Only that I'd have to send somebody else in to get the particulars, but I can definitely cook it if I had to. So if things get tight in this economy, I've got a fallback.
You got a nice side job.
Exactly.
Breaking Bad.
Exactly. So when I go to the res, come and find me. You'll never find me. I dare you. Come and find me. There's no street lights out there. It gets dark at sundown. So the point, though, that was my career, and I enjoyed it. But I really enjoyed that I realized as my career was waning that younger officers were looking into trying to understand how to impact some of the dope cases they were. This was my expertise. So I made it a point as one of the NARC teams. I would go out and talk to all the guys on the street, like your streets crime squads, your patrol, directed activity patrols, and younger officers say, hey, how do we do this? Or what do you look at? And I would sit there. I would sit there after briefing, go, okay, this is what you want to do. Take a look at this. And then I'd give my number, which was a mistake. I get my contact number and say, if you got a question, call me. And of course, you guys always had a question, 2, 3, 4 in the morning.
In the morning.
Not and during my shift. I would go home at 8 and the phone wouldn't stop ringing until 5. And I'm like, okay, it's time to get up again. But I enjoyed that part of it because instructing others were going to take over where I left off. And that's what I really enjoyed.
Is that what prompted you to take a position as a police chief over an entire department? I mean, that love of the job and instilling those values in good old-fashioned police work.
I think I can say when I went to tribal law enforcement, it was different than what the Bureau, and you call them the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs. Indians know them as a Boston Indians Around agency. We're more intimate with those guys than I think most people think. But when I went down to become a tribal officer, it was my intent to just essentially work as long as I could as a tribal cop. I never thought about being an top administrator. But I saw some of the things in tribal law enforcement that were faced in any law enforcement. Funding, staffing, resources, the laws. Oh, God, the laws that were... I never run into the kind of issues that here in Phoenix that I faced on the reservation. But when I became chief, it was... The true story of how I became chief was more of an option than it was an opportunity. I was a commander of Gila River. I was asked to go down by the chief when I was a sergeant of Fort McDowell to take on and help develop their special enforcement squad and take over the patrol division. It was like a lieutenant's job in the Phoenix PD. But I said, okay, with no formal education or any kind of background, I figured, jump into there. All you can do is fail. And I've been okay so far, so I did. I handled the position, and I started training the guys, and now I found a niche where I was becoming effective because now I was affecting the efforts of officers at a larger scale than I had ever affected one-on-one with, say, detectives, young officers here. And I never thought that I would ever be more than a commander. I actually was satisfied with that. Guys coming into my office saying, hey, commander, can we do this? Hey, how about that? Answer this question. And I did. But then politics entered in with the chief's issue, and he was going to leave. He walked into my office one bleak Tuesday morning and said, commander, I'm leaving in 30 days. Okay. I recommended you take over the department interim until they get a new chief. Now, that sounds like a great opportunity, except you had 3 senior commanders already there. Now, you want to talk about a little bit of animosity, even on the tribal side. The old Indian barter was not going to get me out of this one.
And you talk about the politics.
Right,
politics. And, yeah, there's always politics at that level.
So, exactly. And I ended up being selected to take over the position while the chief was still there. And I'll tell you straight up, I had no idea how to run a police department. I had no idea how to administer a law enforcement program. The limited experience I got was as a lieutenant commander over patrol division and a special enforcement squad. When I took that job, the chief said, I will break you down, Ray, in the next 30 days. I will sit with you. I will mentor you. I will show you everything you need to know. Well, day 30 turned into day 29, 28, 27, 15, 10, 7, 6, 5.
And then it's 5. D-Day.
Yeah, and at about 9:30 in the morning on the last day of his life, when he was in with our PD, last day of his political life, I walk into his office. Hey, chief, are you going to ever sit down? And he goes, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm leaving, Ray, and what you need to know, look in that file there are all my prior records and issues. Over here are the forms I've been working on. In my desk, the second drawer on the desk, are probably everything I need for the council reports. And by the way, they're probably going to be looking for one next Monday. And I'm like, okay. He said, oh, yeah. And I said, any advice? And he's walking out, holding his briefcase and his helmet for his motorcycle. He goes, oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Goodbye. Good luck. Left. That was his transitional speech. Highly motivational, as you might add.
Almost like your OJT when you were in a Bureau of Indian Affairs as a young rook.
Exactly, going, I'm going to throw rocks at him.
Yeah.
Here we go. BIA has definitely affected this guy. So I'm standing here basically bare naked in the showroom going, how in the world am I supposed to run? I have no idea. So I didn't know where to look, what to look for, or how to, even if I was looking at it, what was I looking at? So I had to dive into it, and that's to say, the operations of the department didn't stop. So it was, oh, commander, hey, you're in charge. So when they're not congratulating you, they've got a question. They've got an option. And then you get the politics coming in with the concerns. So I'm like, holy crap. And then I learned as a chief that you fly or you die. And there was kind of the going joke in Gila River when I was chief. If I could last till Friday of any given week, I had another week. Because they didn't fire anybody until Friday.
So everything was about Friday.
So if you lasted until noon Friday when HR went home, you're going to be able to come back Monday. If he walked into your office before noon, well.
In closing,
sir,
looking at what you did at the helm of the Gila River Indian Reservation, yes, and all your career, looking at what's going on now, what bit of advice would you give to police chiefs that, because there's going to be a lot of changes.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, we're going to talk about that in the next segment of Cop Talk.
We're at the bare bottom of what's coming.
Yes. And there's going to be a lot of new police chiefs.
Absolutely.
What kind of advice would you give them dealing with the turmoil, and I hate to use the word politics, as well as the communication? You spoke so well about that.
Right.
What kind of advice would you give them today?
To the chiefs that are going to be, what's facing law enforcement today? I think you and I and all of us in the room who work these streets can go back in our own careers and show what changed in our own careers. I hear the carotid is so terrible and that kind of thing, but it went away. It went away essentially when I was here.
Yeah, it went away a long time ago. It did. They talked about it now. It went away a long time ago.
I don't want to say rhetoric, but...
Yeah, but apparently it's not that way throughout the nation.
This is a fact.
But here's something I keyed on when all of us going on, and you asked me, if you always remember, and some of you, and Jason, you might have came on when mandatory drug testing was already in place.
Yes. Yes.
I came on when the polygraph was optional. And I think it was mandatory when you came on.
Right? Jesus, I took nine of those things.
I'll tell you. And I think it was the day that Phoenix detectives walked into the academy and arrested a candidate, a recruit, for burglary.
Wow.
Who had signed on because the polygraph was not used.
Yeah.
And they got him on prints.
Wow.
After that, it was mandatory. And I remember when drug testing was optional for some internal affairs investigations. But the reality was, when it first came down, I remember Plea and the union, and the officer stood up and said, no, it's officers are honest, they're this, they're that, and they took the argument, and then we found officers were involved with it.
We have
and
some
The reality of change is there. To the chiefs coming on, the reality of change is what you're now facing with. This tragedy that occurred in Minneapolis should be looked upon as a challenge that they take under the straps and say to the same thing that they can tell their people, the same thing I told my people the first day I took over the department in Gila River. I said, you people have done so little for so long, you think that mediocrity is the only measure of success. I said, I'll tell you right now, mediocrity stops because I no longer accept it as a standard for performance. Secondly, none of you will be treated like the way I was treated in the ranks of the draconian conduct of the Phoenix PD, which I could say I probably had some issues with authority at the time. And the last thing I told them, I said, and in return in response for their commitment to change what needs to be changed at the root level, the successes that they would achieve from that would be theirs to enjoy. The failures that we would be confronted with were mine to explain. That was the standard I left them with.
That's
a perfect way to end it.
That's incredibly beautiful. And I love, mediocrity is not
acceptable.
Acceptable. It's not something to achieve. You don't achieve mediocrity, especially in law enforcement.
Right.
You achieve the... I don't even know the right word. It's not even a goal.
Be the best
you
can
just
be.
Simply do the job with honor and integrity, and you will find a few people.
Yeah.
Of course, any business has a few people, but mediocrity in law enforcement, that word should never, ever be used. Average is not okay.
As the Army guy, I have to say, be all you can be.
Yeah, no.
That's Air Force.
No, we are not. Hold on.
I thought that was
Air Force. On Army.
Time out, Robin.
I thought that was Air Force.
Robin, thank you.
I thought that was Air Force, dude.
I was going to point out to the chief that the only reason that he had any issues as a United States Air Force serviceman in the country of Korea, I never had any issues. So that's a whole Army thing. I don't want to hear your two bullshit about that was your mistake.
Chief. I hated URA. I wasn't going to say URA.
You should have joined the Air Force, and then you would have had no issues on any level. So thank you, Robin, for having my back on that.
Well, I'm an Air Force daughter and an Air Force mom, and I sure did like having my house full of Air Force young men when my son graduated. Yes.
And on that note, we'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
I'll never forget.
Never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
My first call up ever as a member of the National Guard.
When we got to the armory, they briefed us on the wildfires. They were getting dangerously close to homes.
Helicopters were going out to drop water on the fires.
Guys in the unit were preparing for firefighting with local fire crews.
At that moment, I got my first taste of just how important the Guard is to my community.
See how the Guard can be an important part of your life at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired Police Sergeant Darren Birch and retired Police Officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to Badge Boys, everybody. Awesome episode with Chief Neho, and I'm excited that he has stayed to participate in our cop talk because obviously it's no secret. What are we going to talk about? the current state of affairs, and if you turn on the TV, it's what everybody's talking about, and the last thing I want to be is another one of these talking heads. But I think that it's important to give our perspectives, especially to the law enforcement officers out there, and hopefully there's a lot of civilians that are listening that will get a little bit of a different viewpoint, because things can weigh heavy on you if you dedicate yourself to only reading one news outlet. If you only dedicate yourself to listening to one news outlet, you it's impossible.
Don't live in a bubble.
It's impossible to get the truth and the facts and to form your own opinion, because you will quietly, behind closed doors, just become a talking head. So, Darren, you texted me this morning. And this is one of the things, we've talked about this a lot. It's one of the things I love so much about this show. Believe it or not, truly, every week, Darren and I come in here, 98% of the time, I don't know who our guests are. I don't know what Cop Talk is about. We've already talked off air that I want to talk about something that Darren is looking at me going, what is it? And I'm saying, I'm not going to tell you till we get to it. And Darren is going to talk about something that he's a little more educated on. And we're going to start with, obviously, the epicenter of the current state of our country occurred in Minneapolis a couple weeks ago with the murder of George Floyd. Just this morning, the Minneapolis police chief had a press conference. I did not listen to it in two parts. Number one, I was at our academy passing on the guide on to a new class of new recruits, a huge honor, something that I truly valued and cared about. But had I been doing nothing this morning, I can honestly say I don't think I would have watched this press conference, because I am so tired of the bullshit that these high-ranking people and politicians are saying. However, Darren, you watched it.
I took
some notes. And I'm anxious to hear what the police chief said, what your thoughts are on it, and then everybody can forgive me for whatever my response may be to that.
You know, I will tell you this. I don't know that police chief. I've never met him. I haven't seen any kind of briefings with him in it. I know nothing about him other than what I saw today.
You know what's sad, though?
Please.
What is sad in this day and age is you can't just say, police chief, what ethnicity is he?
He is a black male.
That right there, it's essential. We have no choice but to acknowledge that, but it pisses me off. It should simply be, he's the police chief of Minneapolis. Okay, go ahead.
And he talks about having that lens as a black police officer, as a black community member, and then now as a black police chief. I will say all the good things I saw in his briefing. He was intelligent. He was articulate. He seemed like he was coming from a place of genuine belief. It did not sound disingenuous. He talked a lot about moving forward. He also talked to certain groups. For example, first thing he said to the public, you will not be abandoned. That was beautiful. When you have city council that's talking about not defunding the police, but literally abolishing
Lisa Bender, the president of the city council wants to live in a police-free society.
Because 911 is a privilege. Yeah, I mean, it's insane.
Calling 911 is a privilege. Did you know that, Robin? It's a privilege.
Good luck to anybody that doesn't want police, right?
If you help my kidnapped child, or I'm a rape victim, or my home is broken into, that's a privilege.
Yeah, it is.
To call the police. I can't believe it. I didn't realize that. Yeah. I'm almost 50 years old. I never knew that.
So I love how he came in and immediately addressed the public. We're here, and we're not going anywhere. Love that. He also said, I work for and serve the people. Again, beautiful. And then he talked to the cops, or talked about the cops more than to the cops. He said the countless officers whom said that they are not this former police officer, who he then said, I refuse to mention by name.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
So outstanding.
Then to the business owners, he said, quote, I wish I could carry those burdens alone so you wouldn't have to. I like that.
God, that's beautiful.
And then to the world, he made a declaration. He said, quote, beginning today, I'm immediately withdrawing from the contract negotiations with the Minneapolis Police Federations.
The union?
Yes.
Yes.
He has completely disavowed the union. He says that this will give us greater flexibility for real reform. And sadly, that's a true statement, depending on the unions.
It's an incredibly true statement.
Depending on the union.
It's an incredibly true
statement. I'm not here to denounce all unions at all, because I was a police officer when they afforded us fairness. And then I was a sergeant where I saw that some bad apples kept coming back.
But there's no disagreement. And if you want to disagree, please do.
Oh, of course, my friend.
Derek Chauvin had many opportunities to not be wearing a uniform, not be on that call that day, not murder George Floyd, and he was, because of one reason: the police union up there.
Absolutely.
And that was the thorn. Okay. That's not okay.
That was the thorn in this police chief's side. That was so obvious.
Good.
He said that the dissolving of the contract will not affect wages or benefits.
No.
That's something that was important for the police officers here. But it was about change as they look at critical incident, change as they look at use of force, change as they look at disciplines and grievances and arbitration, which go in with the collective bargaining that goes with the unions. Those are the things that he's going to change. The one thing that bothered me that he didn't address, and me and Chief Neho talked about this, and we both came to the same conclusion. There's a beautiful president, Truman, who said, the buck stops here. He took no accountability and said, I'm in charge, I stand accountable. That's the one thing I missed.
Yeah,
it was always the finger pointing. He talked about the union being at fault. When some of the questions came to the effect of, there's two police officers who literally were on days, just days, literally. And now they have a senior officer with 20 years who's telling them, shut up, I got it, we're fine. And they asked, do you see any kind of mitigating? Do you feel bad for them? And he said, I don't care if you're on for a day or 20 years, you do your job. And I get the sentiment as it relates to the reality that you have a duty to perform. And the second you think, and that's the key, you think that this man is doing something lethal, something unlawful, something harmful. And there was clearly that element present, because we all heard the video. We all heard him literally begging, saying, officer, I can't breathe, please, officer. So that was there. But I didn't understand the lack of humanity to the rank and file, in terms of, I understand there is an issue when someone has one day on and that officer saying that. My take is, do I hold those two less responsible than that? As the police chief said, I won't say his name, and I won't. That guy was a piece of shit.
No, I love how you're leading into my,
I don't
my
hold
question
them,
that I want to ask you.
I don't hold them as culpable, and I'm hoping that the attorney general will feel the same and allow them, even though appropriately arrested they were. I hope
and appropriately lost their jobs.
And appropriately lost their jobs.
Yes.
You can't unring that bell.
No, you can't.
You had to provide for that dying man at the hands of now a murderer. And they failed.
Yes.
But I am in, maybe it's because I've been a cop too long, but I just feel that there's some mitigating circumstances for having literally a day on the job, as Chief Neho talked about when he was handed a bad gun. We don't know how good of the training they received. I don't know that. Uh-huh. I don't know what kind of atmosphere. I don't know all those factors. I'm going to give them the benefit of doubt to the extent that I'm hoping we can provide state's witness against this monster at the hands of those two officers for a more lenient sentence. Not immunity, but a more lenient sentence. Because maybe I'm just too much of a lenient man. I don't know.
Well, you are a very kind, humble, lenient man, unlike me. But I love how, without knowing what I was going to bring up, you led right into what I was going to say. And I want Chief Neho to weigh in on this, because here's something that is not getting talked about. And first of all, let me preface this with the Lisa Vendors of the world, the anti-abolish police, the fund police. It's in my 48 years on this earth, it's the most absurd, ridiculous statements. It's not going to happen. You have to have law enforcement or you do not have a United States of America. And on this podcast, we have dedicated ourselves for more than a year and a half to speaking positively. But of course, we have to also speak realistically. Derek Chauvin brought to light a serious culture problem in law enforcement. A lot of you guys out there, law enforcement, are not going to agree with this. A lot of you will understand this. And I got to tell you, I don't care on either side. It's just simply the truth. And this is not 100%. This is still, we're in the 10% range. But yes, racism plays an issue. I talked about last week, I'm not in Derek Chauvin's heart. He had 19 years. How many days are in 19 years? How many shifts did he spend that he had an opportunity to murder a black person and he didn't do that? So I'm a little less concerned about that. I want to reform and build law enforcement and community relations. So here's my issue. When I found out after last week's show, we talked about what we talked about, and those other officers, I was jumping on the bandwagon. I'm glad these other guys got arrested, and you were talking about the one who had his back turned and was facing the crowd and shouldn't have been arrested. But then we find out two of those officers had 4 days on the job. Chauvin was their training officer, okay? I don't believe that the training you get in most academies is bad. I think there are certifications that you have to pass, and you get good training, and the people that I know that work at academies do it for the right reason. Then you get out on the street. Well, all of a sudden, you have a real badge, a real gun. You have taken the oath of office. You can take people's freedoms away. You can take children away from their parents. It is a very serious issue.
And the real training begins.
And yes. And what Chauvin, once I found out that two of these officers had been on for only 4 days, and when you watch what Chauvin did, I'm not saying, please don't mistake me, I'm not saying that race did not play an issue in it. I don't know for a fact if it did, because I wasn't in his heart. But what you can see very, very clearly is that Chauvin was showing his trainees, this is how you do it.
Take care of business.
And that is a serious problem. Darren, I'll tell you again, Chief, please jump in anytime. I'm not going to say any names. I had two. In the city of Phoenix, when you go through what's called field training, it's about 3 months. And you have two field training officers. You have one for 6 weeks. You have another one for 6 weeks. Then you're on your own for a couple weeks. They monitor you until they say, you know what, he is good to go. He's what we call 10-8, squared away. On one particular, I'm pretty new, my first field training officer, and I had gotten to the point. And I'm 2 weeks out of the academy, right? So I'm still scared shitless of what's going on, trying to figure this job
out.
That's
what you really learn.
I'm trying to understand what even the dispatcher's saying on the radio, like, comprehend. We're just human beings. And we were on our way to an emergency call, okay? And in the city of Phoenix, our policy and procedure states you will not go over 15 miles over the speed limit, correct?
That's correct.
That's what it says. So I'm on my way to an emergency call on one of my first days of being in the driver's seat, and I have my FTO yelling at me, berating me. And then,
what the hell are you thinking?
Well, and guess what happened the next day? He had me called into our supervisor's office to basically get me in trouble and throw me under the bus for following procedure. And I explained to the sergeant, look, I'm 2 weeks on, I'm following policy and procedure. And thankfully that sergeant had my back, but I learned very early on that there are some training officers, and again, what I'm talking about is Chauvin brought this to light. You can see it on the video. To me, as a former law enforcement officer, it is incredibly clear what he was doing. He was expressing his dominance, not over necessarily a black man,
but the streets.
Not even necessarily over a criminal. He was showing the new guys, this is how you do it. And that is a problem in law enforcement that needs to be corrected. How do we, when you're talking about the unions or when you're talking about things that are seen and unseen, caught on video, not caught on video, that's the one that really got me, was looking at him going, you should have never. There are two guys who have not only lost their job,
their lives are destroyed, they are facing
prison time, their lives are destroyed. Are they culpable? Yes, in some ways.
Yeah, they are.
Are they responsible? Yes, in some ways. But
as a cop,
he failed them miserably, because I know
he failed all of us.
They graduated the academy 4 days prior to that, and I remember that feeling of putting that badge on for the first time, taking that oath of office. There is no feeling in the world like this. You do not graduate the academy going out there and saying, oh my God, I'm free to kill somebody. No, Chauvin did that. So I just want to know what your thoughts are on the older officers have a responsibility to train the new officers in the right way. And so many times in a lot of careers, it's, oh, you've been here 20 minutes. I don't give two shits what you think. You don't know this job. That's the attitude, and it's scary.
I love the question because it gets us to go.
Chief's over here. We giggling. Get to go. I must be doing something right over here because the chief's giggling.
We get to go full circle. Because what's the very first thing I told you, Jason, when I introduced this dear law enforcement professional, Chief Neho, who has so much respect from everyone that's ever worked with him and for him, because he does the right thing for the right reason. He's not afraid to get his hands dirty. Uh-huh. He's out there. He's cleaning up the community. He's doing his best. And the first thing I told you is, I said, Jason, have you ever had that one officer you worked with, whether it be a senior officer or not, that you looked at and you wanted to mirror? That's what we need. Is racism going to become this, I don't want to say deterrent, but it almost becomes a red herring, in my opinion, because now we're talking about racism. What we need to be talking about is street justice and heavy-handed police work by pieces of shit like this gentleman who I won't say his name.
Accountability.
It's the accountability that I didn't see with the police chief when he's talking about everything else but himself. When you have a training officer like I had, in the sense of a senior officer like Chief Neho, who was an officer with me on my squad, I looked up to him and I saw the right way to do things. And when you're learning, that's what you need out there, not heavy-handed police tactics. So the reform that we need to go moving forward has to do with that aspect of the quote-unquote taking care of business. You know, it's our streets. It's not us against them. We're in this community. And I don't mind talking about racism because people have it. There are racists in this world. There's no doubt about
it.
But there's nothing
systemic. It's inherent in human... It just exists.
It does.
In every aspect.
But I don't think that's the issue why we're where we're at today. What we saw with that murder, and that's what it was. It was, I think,
cold-blooded murder.
Yes. And these two poor officers, who I think are absolutely culpable because they had to hear the cries and say, I got to do the right thing in my heart.
Well, one of them did say, though. He did say twice.
I know. He just didn't stop it.
Yeah, exactly.
He didn't stop it.
The culpability and the mitigating fact, all that stuff will come out in court, right, which is what should happen.
It
That's why we have law enforcement.
So with all that, I now want to go to you, Chief. And having heard both Jason and I talk about this issue on all those different levels, point us where we're wrong and point us where we're right, my friend.
Well, I'll comment. I don't know if I'm right or wrong. The arguments are strong on both sides. I'll tell you what I saw in looking at it from a retired law enforcement officer and maybe an administrator. One thing I believe what Jason said is true, socialization. I see socialization. I see culture. And the, how would you say, the loss of accountability, structure of the Minneapolis Police Department that led to what happened to that victim. When I say socialization, I talk about the two young patrolmen who had days on the job. I would have never fathomed, even when I started putting a rook on the street after 4 days by himself. When I came on, Phoenix had no structured FTO program.
No.
I was one of the few to be able to sit down and help build some of that, basically in its beginning. But I went solo in 5 weeks, and everybody thought, my God, that's accelerated. Well, I got lucky. I got a sergeant who pushed and, you know, kind of laid the law down. But 5 weeks was thought of as, man, that's extreme, because you're supposed to go minimum of 8 in those days, but you didn't have a structured FTO. That's my structure failure right there with the PD. The chief has to own that.
Thank you.
He signed off on those programs. He could not know that that FTO program did not exist. As a standard of training throughout the nation. You know, all you had to do is, if you wanted to learn something, come to Phoenix PD and let them show up. I know they have chiefs organizational meetings. Where did they not change those ideas? Okay, with that failure, you got two guys now that are facing homicide charges. Now you got socialization of those two guys. As you said, do what's right. I tell you, shut up, whatever. You know, you'll do what I tell you to do. To the FTO, we'll tell you this. And the same thing you learned. We all learned growing up. I said, I face the same thing when I voiced an opinion to a sergeant or another officer, senior officer, and my FTO standing there going, how long you had on the job, Ray? I'm like, my first week. He goes, you don't have an opinion. Okay. So shut you up where you know where your boundaries are. But the socialization of the officers, young officers coming up the ranks, and ones that are going to come after these and ones that have gone before, if there is a certain standard of what you allow to occur. Back in the day, we had the carotid. Remember how we were supposed to take them down? But how many did the Phoenix death drop out there? Okay, that was, you're going to mete out some street justice. And it happened. It happened because it was acceptable conduct. And the more acceptable conduct you allow, the less accountability you're going to have. I'll give you a case example from tribal law enforcement. I was trying to hire officers in my old department out there in Gila River. I had an officer who came in from another tribal department who was denied and decertified from the tribal department, but applied to Gila River. Why were they decertified? Because they were fired for, one, drug use, possession, and intent to sell. Marijuana. Okay? Now, they applied to the PD, thinking that another tribal department would pick them up. In the olden days, this was acceptable conduct. This was the socialization of tribal departments throughout the nation in many respects, and there was less accountability. So when I sat down with that officer and I denied the application, they got upset. They were livid. This was wrong. This was bias because they didn't realize I was Indian. So they threw down the blanket. And I said,
threw your blanket down?
Yeah, I said, basically, no. I said, you know, I hunted buffalo like you did. So here, where am I? And this is what the officer said. He goes, you read the packet, but it was unfair how I was treated. I said, okay, so tell me how it was unfair. Okay, so maybe I smoked. And maybe I hand it off to people in the community. But I never did it on duty, and I never did it in a uniform. And I'm looking at the officer, and I look at my internal affairs sergeant, I look at the officer, I'm going, duh, really? Next call to made was post. They're going, look at this officer certification, we forwarded the statement. That officer believed in the culture of what that officer grew up in. They were socialized to actually believe that that was acceptable conduct, as long as you didn't do it in the car and didn't do it in uniform, you were okay to do everything because for the rest of the day, you were the guardian of the public, even though you were victimizing the very oath of office that you took to protect the public. That's the second failure I saw on this issue. And now when you come to the issue of the officers themselves and the question I had to about accountability, I've heard the argument both ways that, you know, these officers may be given consideration. I believe by the law and standard, they probably will. Your primary suspect, Chauvin, will likely go for the steepest charge.
Yes.
And if he's not stupid, yes, he'll fight it. He'll fight it because he knows he's going down anyway. The 9-year veteran, he may plead to a lesser charge. But the two officers, one of them, or not both of them, is going to turn state's witness.
For sure the one who actually spoke up,
exactly,
twice.
So he's like, no guys will. Are likely to look at lesser issues, lesser time, but their careers are over. They're, yes, going to do time.
Oh.
And that's how I look at the result. But then I go back to, should they be given this consideration because they were rookies? Should they have been given consideration because they were caught up in this structure of the department, that they were faced with the socialization pressure that they couldn't act or they believed they couldn't act under the time when they should have acted? And I go back to a movie. I mean, you guys saw it called A Few Good Men.
Oh. Absolutely.
Oh, at the my top three.
You can't handle
one of
the
my
truth.
Top three.
At the very end, when those two Marines were saying all the charges except conduct unbecoming a Marine.
Yep.
They were found guilty.
They
remember?
Were found guilty.
When I first saw that movie, going, these guys are going to get done for Article 134, conduct unbecoming.
Right.
Sure enough, it doesn't catch all article.
Yeah, it is.
But it was the statement of the young private when he said, we didn't do anything wrong. And the corporal finally said, yeah, we did. Yeah. We were supposed to protect people who couldn't fight for themselves.
Right.
That's what those officers failed, yeah, to do.
Yes.
The bottom line argument of what they're involved with, even if they were going to be chastised when they went back to the department for calling a supervisor, the old, you call a sergeant too many times, you may be going on calls all alone, or your backup may slow down before they get there, or you may hit the one door that all of a sudden your team has fallen back on because they don't think you can be trusted, Days of Serpico kind of stuff. Those were the socialization examples that actually occurred, like what I saw with that officer in tribal police. They believed it was right, so they accepted it was right. They would not go against it because they did not want to fall outside the norm of the blue family that they were now stepping into. They didn't want to become closer, I'm sorry to say, the bastard children at the family reunion. You know you're supposed to be there, but you don't feel like you belong. They did not want to live their career with that atmosphere. That's dangerous on the street. In some departments, that's a reality. Sadly, I think Minneapolis had that kind of structure. To the influence party about it, that...
Oh, it's very clear. They have that,
yeah, now, and
structure.
And the one failing that I see with the chief of police is the one thing he didn't say to out there is that I own these failures. If he was going to be a transformational leader, realizing that the structures were existing within his own department for the years he'd been on and the time he'd served on that department, he never once said, I own these failures.
Yes.
These decisions were made. The building was burned down. Issues happened. Our FTO program was bad. These officers, you should have been disciplined better. The union had influence, et cetera. I did not force these, yep, changes as I know they should have been.
All on
I own those failures,
yep,
because the culture of that department is his responsibility. It, yep, mirrors his effectiveness or ineffectiveness.
Yeah.
If the chief is a transition or transitional leader, he accepts the norm as he goes in as the administrator. If the chief is a transformational leader, he attacks the norm and changes it. He faces the risks and he makes the changes happen.
Well, and in true leadership, it should be the absolute norm to say all successes are yours, all failures,
right,
are on me. And when a leader,
Darren
brought that up, one of the things that he, of all the great things he said about the, I don't even know the Minneapolis's,
yeah,
chief's name.
Arredondo.
Of all he said that was great, the one thing that he didn't say is what, mm-hmm, was glaring. And I think that's a great point.
Accountability.
Be accountable. And if, mm-hmm, you are willing to take that, nobody's holding a gun to your head. Mm-hmm. Nobody says you have to be the chief of police. If you accept that job or becoming a field training officer, there are certain responsibilities, mm-hmm, that come with that.
Right.
Successes belong to your troops, failures 100% are on you. And right, he should, I mean,
heavy
the,
is the crown.
The chief of Minneapolis, there is no other recourse but for him to resign. He needs to resign. They obviously need to restructure all the way down to their, I mean, Chauvin went to the academy 19 years ago. His background officer, his training officer back then probably can't be faulted. He developed his own habits and ways of doing things, but there was case after case after case that the union and the administration could have got together and said, look, this guy should not
be a police officer. A bad apple.
And the bottom line is Chauvin should have never been on that call. He should have never been wearing a uniform. And George Floyd should have never been in uniform. And aside from the racism, it is very simple. A man was murdered by a corrupt police officer. That's all there is to it.
I love it. That's all there is to it. That wraps up a great cop talk.
Hell yeah.
And we'll be right back for a little fun and a little relief with Stupid Suspect Stories, Heroic Headlines, and of course, Jason's inspirational message. We'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Batch Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Batch Boys.
Jason, I'm going to do all I can to get Chief Neho to write a book.
Because
that man needs a book.
He needs a book.
Yes, he does. If there's ever a cop that needs to write a book, and we know there's many that have, it is that man.
Yes.
Great, great, great person, great cop. As you know, I put him in a pedestal. You know that. He's practically heroic in my eyes.
Yes.
And so I think no better person to talk to you about heroism and heroic headlines than Jason Schechterly.
Well, this week, without a doubt for me, what I saw yesterday from Mike O'Mara, the president of the New York Police Benevolent Association, and I have my concerns and my issues with the unions across the country. You know, guys like Derek Chauvin, he would not have been a police officer but for the union standing up for him and backing him through all of the previous complaints. I think that is an issue that needs to be addressed. But Mike O'Mara got in front of a group of people yesterday, and it was pretty incredible and almost poetic how he said, you know what, stop treating us like animals. And then he whipped out his badge, and he said that what Chauvin did in Minneapolis does not take the shine off of this badge. It does not take the shine off of all these guys' badges. He was pointing to guys in New York, and New York is getting decimated right now.
They really are.
Seattle is getting decimated. Portland. We have a lot of issues throughout the country. I'm not trying to sound like an alarmist, but we're on the brink of a civil war between law enforcement and this.
Over a false narrative.
The radical movement. So it's not the organizers and the peaceful protesters, which I have no problem with. It's the Antifas and the Black Lives Matters. And, you know, my only problem with that, I'm sure I'm going to get hate mail after this, and I don't really care, but Black Lives Matters, they only matter when it comes to police. They don't care about all the murders that are happening in Chicago with black people. Black Lives Matter should mean that all life matters. But you know what?
It's a hate group.
Indian lives matter. Irish lives matter. Australian lives matters. Egyptian lives matters. Polynesian lives matters. I say the word all lives matters, and guess what I get called?
A racist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the most fucking believable thing to me in the world. But Michael Mara was the first person this week to finally stand up and say, you know what? I am sick of this. Most of us do the job for the right reasons, and we are there to help you. And that is what police officers do. And good men are willing to do violence on your behalf so that you can sleep good at night. That is a simple fact of life. And each thing needs to be taken on a case-by-case basis. I said it last week. I'll say it again. Chauvin should have never been a police officer. I would give anything to spend 5 minutes alone in a room with that guy and take care of it myself. He will go to jail. The law enforcement system will prevail, and we will learn from this. So I give credit to Mike O'Mara for saying what he said yesterday. Somebody at some point has got to stand up and say enough is enough. Law enforcement is not the enemy.
You know, we started the show with a mistake. I said, instead of defend, I changed the vowel and said, it was went from defund to defend.
Yes.
And that's the hashtag we need to kind of start with, is the hashtag defend police. And the defund is simply rhetoric to attack police. That's all it is. That's all it is. Good for you. Well, again, I take us down to the bowels of humanity, because you take us way up high. I'm going to take us way down low. So my stupid suspect story is headline, arsonist lights himself on fire while trying to torch a barbershop.
What?
Yep. During these riots, a guy is
outstanding.
Trying.
Outstanding.
Yeah, right, right. Darwin theory at best. A guy trying to burn down a new barbershop in Madisonville, Kentucky, on Sunday morning, lit himself on fire. First, a woman gets out of a white minivan, and this is all captured on surveillance video, by the way. The woman gets out of this minivan, pops a Ford Windstar, whatever it was, is parked at the back of the shop, and she breaks the window. Kind of sound like an Antifa starter kit. Then a guy in a red t-shirt exits. He has shorts on, and he tosses a flaming Molotov cocktail through the window of this business, the broken window. He reaches back into the van and grabs a second flaming bottle. But when he throws it at the building, some of the liquid falls on him and his leg catches on fire. The video shows him quite clearly acting like a rooster with his head cut off. He takes off running across the parking lot, moving so fast that he does a face plant into the lawn. He zigzags his way back before losing one of his shoes. One of his shoes flies off.
Do you ever notice that crime scenes on TV, that there's always a shoe just laying there?
Yes,
every
yes.
single crime scene that the news depicts, there's a shoe.
And this piece of shit idiot did just that. Hey, and by the way, hey, dumb shit, your feet sweat, and it's called DNA. We're going to get you. And then they drove off after, you know, starting the fire. So they did start a fire. Yeah. stupid suspect story. My last one is Apple is tracking iPhones stolen by looters. It's called GPS, guys. Apple has an eerie message for all the looters who have pillaged the stores in recent protests. Thieves who made off with the iPhones from the recent ransacked Apple retail locations, all of them across the nation, they're going to learn very quickly that the gadgets have been loaded with a special security software as their displayed message on their screens. If they power them up, they're going to get this message, quote, please return to Apple Walnut Street or wherever the location is. And then the message goes on, quote, this device has been disabled and is being tracked. Local authorities have been alerted. I love that. I love that.
So what's the point in looting the Apple store? There isn't a point.
You know, they're just... Again, you know, that was the elephant in the room with that Minneapolis police chief didn't talk about, was the looting, the attack on police, the purge of police, the surrender of a police station. That wasn't in his prepared remarks. He didn't even address that.
And what happened after that? It got burned up.
Burn, baby, burn.
Burned to the ground. And he didn't even address that in terms of his responsibility, his accountability during his prepared remarks.
And why didn't he?
And he should
that,
have.
Answer me that question honestly. Why didn't he answer that?
Because he is on a job interview. He is continuing forward.
He is beholden to the politicians who only care about their next election. And I don't care what anybody says. I don't care what any there's no politicians listening to our podcast.
they might now.
But there's not a single one of you out there who genuinely cares about fixing this. All you care about is how you look, your next job, and your next reelection. And I've said it time and time again, and I will say it until I'm blue in the face. I don't care how much trouble I get in. Every politician, from the president right down to the smallest town mayor in this country, every one of you should go straight to hell.
And ladies and gentlemen, that is his inspirational message.
That is my inspirational message.
Wow.
I am so fucking tired of listening to these politicians talk about the change they want to make. And it's just nothing but lies. And I truly believe that. And I'm sure there's some that would argue, no, it's really my heart, Jason. I really want to help you. No, you don't. You don't want to help your community. You want to get reelected and you want to have power. That's why you got it. That there's a reason I didn't. You know how many times I've been invited to join politics to run for something?
Oh, I bet.
Over the last 19 years? You know why I don't?
But you hate the animal.
Well, I'm not narcissistic enough. I'm not.
It's not all about you.
Power hungry enough. It's disgusting to watch what's happening. Anyway, I don't even know how you transition into an inspirational story.
But, it is vote. Get out there and vote for the right leaders.
Well, yeah, that's your power because it is about us as citizens of the United States. But, you know, just to all the police officers out there, again, please, this entire thing that has gone on for the past month, all I think about is Mark Atkinson, who lost his life in the line of duty on March 26th of 1999. He's the reason I became a police officer. I've never lost sight of that. Think, when you're alone at night, when you close your eyes, when you put your head down on the pillow, and it's just you, think about why you even signed up to do this job. You've got to try and ignore the media and the politicians are 100%. We're in the cycle right now that law enforcement is the enemy. Law enforcement is not the enemy. It is why we have the country that we have. It's why we have the freedom that we have. It's why my kids are safe. And it is why you have the ability to get things taken care of. No matter what you hear, for God's sakes, please do not lose sight of why you signed up to do this job. And if you do it with honor and you do it with integrity, it is the most rewarding career in the world, guaranteed. God bless all of you. Please, please try and stay safe. And we will, I'm sure, unfortunately, Jesus Christ, be talking about this again next Wednesday. But we'll be back and we will talk about it. God bless. See you later.
Batch Boy. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired Police Sergeant Darren Birch and retired Police Officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys, heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide Networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.